The story is Chasing Sam Maguire, the All-Ireland Football Championship 1928 to 1977 by Dermot Riley and independent sports journalist Colm Keyes, with the foreword by Uachtaráin Cumann Lú Clascaoil, Larry McCarthy. Dermot Riley, good morning.
Good morning, Clem. How are you?
Well, I'd say congratulations first, because this is a remarkable book and one that I'm so looking. Over 450 pages, and it's only covering the first 50 years of the All-Ireland Championship.
Well, it took almost 450 years to put it together, Clem.
I can well believe it. Tell me about the background and what drove you to do this.
Clem, this started out embarrassingly for me, but it's more than 10 years ago. And our initial plan was to prepare a list of everybody who played in or was part of a panel on All-Ireland Final Day. So the first man in the book was Martin Walsh from Kildare Round Towers. And we began to begin, Colm and I began to build a picture of all of the players. And as you can imagine, that required a lot of research, a lot of digging. We got into the papers, we got into people's brains, etc. And it began to expand from there. And we decided we will make this a chronology, not just of the players, but the games, the season, etc. So it grew and grew and grew exponentially. And as you say, we've only covered the first 50 years. But the initial plan, as I say, was just to record the names. So instead of having C. Ryan, we would have Clem Ryan, and we would have his club, his nickname, if it's relevant. And as I say, it just grew and grew to what you have in front of you now.
Dermot, regarding the book, and of course it has the great, great story about the Maguire brothers in the 1952 final, where brothers played on both sides, Cavan from Mee and Meath, the family having moved originally from Cavan, and one of them stayed loyal with the home county and the other stayed loyal to the other one. But let's start back in 1928. Kildare 2-6, Cavan 2-5. And I note that you have a photo of the Cavan team of 1928, which pipped Kildare in their bid to become the first holders of Sam Maguire, and only an artist's impression of the Kildare team. How's that?
Well, we have some, and did have some, photographs of the Kildare team, not taken on the day, Clem.
All right.
But there were a few gaps. And there were, I suppose, given that the thing is over 90 years old, we went, the people in Gaelic Art were kind enough to give us a copy of their specially commissioned drawing of the Kildare team from 1928. So that's what we ultimately decided to put in the book. And I think it gives a fair impression of what the place looked like at the time.
It did, indeed. Now, that was the 1928 final. In 1929, Kerry won 8, Kildare won 5. Kildare losing two finals in a row.
Well, we won in 28, we lost in 29.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry. Yeah. 28, yeah. Of course. 2-6 to Cavan's 2-5. That lovely statue that's over in Kildare Town of Bill Squires Gannon commemorating that particular game, yes. And then the following year, defeat.
Well, in 1930, we lost out in the semi-final against all the odds, and against all predictions, to Monaghan in an outrageously wet, miserable day in Croke Park, but perhaps it has something to do with something that maybe has besieged Kildare teams over the years, but overconfidence, because there is no question but that in that period from 1926 for the next 6 years, Kildare and Kerry were sort of 50-50 in terms of preeminence in the game. But we were caught out in 1930. And of course, Monaghan got to the final and took the mother and father of all beatings from Kerry in the final. But we were back in 1931. And I'm glad to say that one of the two of the main men there were my own club mate, our clubmates Dermot Burke and Bill Heinen.
After whom the Dermot Burke Cup is named for the Senior Football Championship here, am I right?
That's absolutely correct. And Dermot was a man I knew, but everybody in Carbery knew Dermot. And I had the privilege, as a very young teenager, of lining out with Dermot, who was in his 60s, for the Carbery junior team.
I was going to say, you must be very old, Dermot Riley.
Yeah, I am very old.
In regards to what you said there. Bill Hyland, was it just mentioned? Where was
Bill
he?
Heinen.
Where was he
Bill
from?
Bill Heinen was from Carbery as well.
All right.
And he was my late father, who obviously followed the Carbery team for many, many years, would always have said that Bill Heinen was the best footballer he ever clapped an eye on.
Yeah, the scorers, by the way, for that final, just going back to 28 now, I am again. Paul Doyle, 5 points. B. Mangan, a goal. P. O'Loughlin, yes. A goal. TQ, a goal. Sorry, no, if I don't recall, incidentally. 24,700 people at the game. And the gate receipts were £2,007, which would have been a lot of money at the time, of course.
That was big money at the time, Clem, and that would have been a record, because the popularity of the game grew exponentially back in the 20s and 30s, largely driven by the great rivalry between Kerry and Kildare.
Right.
They were setting records every year and every time they met.
Now, you give the full team line out, and so I'm going to read it out for information's sake here at this stage. It's a magnificent book, that's all I can say. This is one you put in the mantelpiece. You'd want to see people look at it even, because it's so well produced. Martin Walsh was in goal, Kildare Round Towers. Tell me something now, in a minute. I'll come back to that in a minute. Was that the final where Cuddy Chanders from Athy, or was that much later?
No, that was 1935.
Cuddy Chanders was much, much later, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was 1935.
Okay, I'll come back to that in a minute, where Cuddy Chanders from Athy had been in goal and was dropped for the final, as I remember. Now, the team was Martin Walsh, Kildare Round Towers, full back line of Mick Buckley of Carra, Matt Goff, Jesus, some great names in this. McKee Barracks, also Leakslip. Gus Fitzpatrick of Naas, would he be the father of the Gus we all know so well?
He would be the father of the Gus we all know so well. Yeah. Absolutely.
Frank Malone of Carra, the great Jack Higgins, after whom the Higgins Cup. McKee Barracks, also Naas, and Jack Hayes from Kildare Round Towers. In the centre, the aforementioned Bill Squires Gannon of Kildare Round Towers, who was captain, of course. I heard a story that he came home with the cup and then he went out to milk the cows.
Absolutely correct. Yes.
Joe O'Loughlin Rathangan. Then the half-forward line was Joe Curtis Naas, Paddy Martin Ellistown, and the great Paul Doyle of McKee Barracks, also Maddenstown and Suncroft. And then the full-forward line, Bill Mangan, Kildare Round Towers, Paddy O'Loughlin Rathangan, and Tom Keogh, who's described as Crumlin Independence Dublin, also Kildare Round Towers, and Port Laois. He was
very
really
well.
Touring. The subs were Dan Ryan Naas, who played, Joe Riley Rathangan, Tom Tow, is it Tow? Tow the nickname? Tom Tow Wheeler of Naas, Paddy Ryan Carbery, Frank O'Toole Griffith Barracks, Peter Pringle Rathangan, Jack Connell Milltown, Pat Darkey Ryan Milltown, and Mick Connor Carra. Oh, there's so many stories behind all those names. And as I say, every All-Ireland final between 28 and 77 has similar treatment. Jump on to 35 then, and Cavan spoiled the party, did they not?
Absolutely. Cavan spoiled the party. We were odds-on favourites, but we didn't reckon with the power of Cavan. And Cavan, in fairness, they became a very strong team, and they won 5 All-Irelands in the 20-year period.
Wow.
After 1933. So they were really a very, very strong outfit.
The superstars of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Right, that particular final now, where Kildare were runners-up, and I'll run through the team very quickly, was Jim Maguire Naas, Bill Mangan, Matt Goff, still playing, Jimmy Byrne from the Army, Peter Waters from Raheens. That Peter Waters, is he the same Waters as the Motors family?
No.
The motor deal is different, right. Jack Higgins again. Frank Sambo Dowling. I'd love to know the story of that nickname. He was from Robertstown. Do you know the story of the nickname, no?
I don't know, but Sam and or Frank Dowling, known as Sam, and his brother Jim Joe from Robertstown. I don't know, and I wouldn't wager a guess as to how Frank got his nickname.
Right.
He was a trainee school teacher at the time.
Okay, yeah, that explains the Dublin Clanagwael club. Paul Matthews, yeah, and Christy Higgins from Naas. Paul Matthews from Athy was the team captain. Christy Higgins from Naas in the middle of the field. Tommy Mulhall Athy, by God. And Tommy Mulhall was a brother of another Mulhall, whose name I can't recall at the minute, but he was the man who had the sports shop in Athy for decades and decades and decades. Tommy Mulhall's brother. Now, someone out there will tell me the name of the man who had the sports shop in the square, where I bought many an item from himself and his wife. Paddy Martin, Ratangan and Castle Dermot was centre forward. Paddy Byrne, Castle Dermot. Two Castle Dermot men in the half forward line. Fair play. Jim Joe Dowling of Robertstown. Mickey Geraghty, Sarsfields. The first mention of the sash. And Tom Keogh again, who was a Garda in Kildare, played with Round Towers and Port Leash. Subs were Jim Dalton, Clane. Pat Cuddy, Chanders, Athy. Jim Fox, Athy. Bernard Dunn, Athy. Three of them. He must be, I wonder if he's something to Paddy Dunn. The Bernard Dunn, but there's another Dunn family there as well in the type. Paddy, here's the pub. John Crofton Raheens. God, there's a great name.
There's a great name.
Because
right.
a John Crofton was to soldier so well for Kildare down through the decades and also managing the team. What a great, great defender, the recent John Crofton. Any relation between them?
Well, other than father and son, no connection whatsoever. But yeah, John Crofton from Raheens was an outstanding player. A very young man at the time, probably a teenager, but his son Johnny, as we all know, went on to grace the scene and play outstanding, and one of the best players I ever played with, against, and a truly brilliant player.
So we're talking about the two John Croftons, father
and
son.
The two John Croftons, and we always called the younger man Johnny.
Yeah, but Johnny didn't play with Raheens, did he?
No, Johnny was a Sarsfields man.
That's right. Of course he was, yeah. Actually, we've been chatting with him lately because he runs a major business over in Kildare Town as well.
Right.
So, John, that's great to hear that story. Now, before we move on from that, tell me the story about the other sub there, by the way, I didn't mention, was James Meaney, whose club was Army Metro. Cuddy Chanders had been in goal for all the games up to that, and
yes,
Jim Maguire then was named for the final from Naas. The stories I heard in Athy over the years was that it was a political thing with a small p, that there was kind of varying influences brought to bear in the selection, as from the perspective as the way teams were picked at that time, maybe county board officers and many, many others brought influence to bear on selecting the team. You're the man with the information. Tell us. Why was Cuddy Chanders dropped?
Well, I have researched this in some detail, Clem, and many, many people. And for generations, we've all been listening to the story that because Cuddy was dropped and we would never have any luck afterwards, and it was the reason we lost out. There's no doubt but that there would have been a degree of what you describe as political small p influence in the whole situation. But I think it's only fair to say that Jim Maguire, who lined out in goals that day, played extremely well, and he had a brilliant record as a goalkeeper. And it's understandable, and it happens regularly when teams are changed in the run-up to an All-Ireland final.
Yeah.
But certainly it is a controversy that raged for years and indeed generations, and to some extent still does.
It's believe me, it still does. There's the Thai people still going around with their noses out of joint in relation to that. And hello to all the Chandras family, still very plentiful around the Thai.
And Cuddy Chandras was a wonderful player, and you know, it must have been devastating at the time.
Look, the book is incredible. I'm going to be reading it between here and Christmas, and of course, I haven't forgotten 98 now, but it's so recent, it's still lively in people's memories. One of the lovely things about the book is, and it's 450 pages, is you have match reports, you have relevant facts, other things happening in the country, you have team lineouts, subs, scoring details, everything in relation to it. You have features called miscellany, like little bits of details about the game, and then the year that was, what was happening basically in Ireland, around the world, in each given year, 1928 to 1977. And just, Dermot, on one final point, one of the photographs I see, as was the custom at the time, the great Mayo captain Sean Flanagan pays respect to the Bishop of Kilmore. That would have been the 51, 52 or 53 final. This was the 1950 final, in fact.
Yeah.
I suppose we're all thankful that the captain isn't bending the knee and kissing the bishop's ring anymore, are we?
Well, we leave that to people to decide. But that was very much part of the culture at the time. And indeed, right up until the mid-60s, the Archbishop of Cashel had the job of throwing the ball in. So it was
And there was a time when the full 30 players, 15 from each side, lined up in the middle of the field.
That's right. And again, that only stopped in the mid-60s.
Did it really?
Yeah.
You're old enough to remember the 60s, Dermot. I can't remember anything about the 60s.
I can remember it vividly. Unfortunately for me, but I can remember, the finals going right back.
I tell you one of, just to finish it on a little personal anecdote, and I love this book. I've been digging in and out of it since I got the copy for myself. Thank you to O'Brien Press, who published it. And we have 5 copies to give away. And I'll tell you how to enter in a minute. Don't do it, or I'll send you to the sin bin, because you'll take away all my other messages at the minute, so don't come in for a second. The photograph on the cover, which I saw inside in the book, and it's Mick O'Connell leaping high into the air, and this was against Down. Was that 60, 61 or 68?
That was 1968.
68,
Down won that match. It was a brilliant game, and that's Mick O'Connell. And behind him, you will see Sean O'Neill. And in front of him, you will see John Purdy.
John Purdy, and Sean O'Neill, one of the great forwards. Sorry, Bernard.
Just to say that Down had a very emphatic victory over Kerry that All-Ireland final day. But in the same year, in the league final, Down had precisely 3 points to spare over Kildare in the National Football League final. So while we didn't win, we had a great year that year, and we weren't too far off the Down standard in 1968.
Okay, and can I tell you, from a little boy in 1968, it was the first All-Ireland final that I saw on television.
My goodness.
Can I say, I was so taken by the black shorts that the Down players, like Sean O'Neill, the two McCartans, the great Paddy Doherty, I thought these guys were exotic. They wore black shorts, for God's sake. The first team that I can recall wearing black shorts, but not the only ones. And they became, and I had a cousin who was a great fan of them as well. Listen, the book read, is it currently available?
Absolutely, in all the best bookshops currently available. If you just say to your listeners, you better get going because stocks are running low. We had our launch in Croke Park last night, and I'm delighted to say stocks are significantly depleted after that.
I'm not surprised. I think this thing is going to sell out. I have a collection of books that chronicle this game and that game and this guy and that guy in terms of all sports, and I cherish them all. But I can safely say this is among the top 2 are 3 at most best books that I've ever seen in terms of the amount of detail in it. At £25, I think it's retailing. Is that right, Dermot?
It's a little bit more.
Is it? What's it?
$34.99, and the 99, the people in O'Brien Press tell me, is really important.
All right. It will
£35, but it's still, I think, a bargain.
If you have a GA fan in your life, folks, this is a fantastic Christmas present, if I might mention this, because it will give you months and months of enjoyed reading. It's so just lovely. If you don't believe me, go and have a look at it in the shops. And I have 5 copies to give away, and this is text or WhatsApp now only. And what I want you to do is just text or WhatsApp with your name and where you're from. Later after the programme, because I don't have time now, I'll pick 5 winners. And I won't pick them. We'll do it at random outside. And we'll announce the 5 winners. And let me tell you this, we're not posting it, all right? Because it would cost us a fortune. You'll have to be willing to come and collect it here at KFM. So you can start texting or WhatsApping now. 08-33-97-97-97. Text or WhatsApp with your name. And would you just stick in the word Sam as well. Now, some entries are coming in already. They're flying, Dermot. Jesus, I tell you one thing.
Wonderful.
They're flying. If you've already entered and you haven't put the name Sam, don't worry about it. But it's gone mad. This is why. Now I'm going to have to try and find all my messages, and it's your fault. In regards to Dermot, congratulations to you.
Thank you very much, Clem. And delighted to say that our first stint of publicity after our launch last night is on Kildare KFM this morning, and I really appreciate the opportunity to tell your listeners all about Sam.
So, and I'm delighted, and I only barely scratched the surface, because we could do a week of programmes on it. I can tell you one thing, that at the minute the entries are flying in for this, and wow, well done and well deserved. And if you're not one of the lucky 5 winners that I'll announce tomorrow morning, folks, this is a really great Christmas present. I'll be reading it, certainly, right up to Christmas and beyond, and adding it to my collection as well. Dermot Riley, good Kildare GA man. Well done. Cogardicus. Untuk. Laur Untuk Erfad. Dermot, thanks for joining us. Well, I can tell you, folks, I have been on this programme over many years, and I've never seen anything like the rush of entries to get hold of this copy of this book, and people trying to find out the name. I know it is pricey at $34.99, as Dermot said, but in terms of it's an encyclopedia of information of those 50 years, 1928 to 1977. And by the way, if you ask the obvious question, why did they stop then? Because book 2, I'm sure, is in the planning from 1977 up to the present day as well. And it really, you know, people are often wondering, what'll I get him or her for Christmas now? Well, there's your answer, among the things. And it's not just a case of commercially endorsing the book. It's an encyclopedia of information. And not just about Kildare, of course, although all the Kildare All-Ireland final appearances, was there about 5 in total, 4 or 5 in total? I know that back in 1919, pre-Sam Maguire. Sure. Isn't that how Kildare got the white jerseys? 1902, 1903, Clane, the flower bags and all of that. But it's the 28, the first Sam Maguire, when Sam Maguire was first played. And I mentioned Squires Gannon. And the story is that Squires Gannon came home. I think they came home on the train or whatever else. There were no big welcoming parties at that time. Brought the cup and went home, and then went out to milk the cows. As you did at the time, no nonsense whatsoever. Anyway, let's move on. And we referenced earlier, as some of our listeners did, what's going on in the world. You know, you have terrorist shootings, random shootings going on, as we heard in Brussels last night. But the biggest, among the biggest unfolding tragedy at the moment has to be, and that's notwithstanding what's going on in Ukraine now for a minute, but in terms of what's going on in Gaza, where reports are saying it has only 24 hours of water, electricity and fuel left, according to the regional head of the United Nations World Health Organization. If the aid is not allowed into the besieged territory, doctors will have to prepare death certificates for their parents, WHO Regional Director for the Eastern Mediterranean or for their patients. The WHO Regional Director for the Eastern Mediterranean, Ahmed Al-Mandari, said in an interview with AFP. Believe it or not, it's 10 days of relentless Israeli airstrikes on targets in the Palestinian enclave at this stage in retaliation for the October 7th attack by the Gaza-based Hamas militants who killed 1,400 people, mostly civilians in southern Israel, and we know the tragedy that has happened since. To tell us more about this, Director MA in Military History and Strategic Studies at Maynooth University, Dr. David Murphy. Good morning, David. Thank you for joining us on the programme this morning. 24 hours among the problems in terms of what might or might not be happening here. Are you there with me, David? Why is David not there? Let's see. David, are you there now?
Now?
Yes, can hear you now, David.
Sorry. Can you hear me? That's good.
I can indeed. David, an unfolding tragedy of terrible proportions.
Yes, I mean, when you look at Gaza, you're looking at over 2 million people packed into a very narrow strip of the world. It's one of the most densely packed areas in the world. It's always under pressure as well. I mean, it doesn't really hit our news until something like this happens. But there are very few crossing points backwards and forwards between Egypt and also between Israel. When you look at, things like hospitals, doctors, there's not an opportunity there for them to build up supply. They don't have surplus. So now they're under pressure. They're not getting, they're not getting in kind of like medical supply. They're not getting in painkillers and anaesthetic and, medical equipment like that. They're also not getting in fuel. There's a shortage of food. So it's when you look at, say, take a large city, kind of like Dublin is now over 1 million people. If you took Dublin, sealed it off with water, food, no electricity, what that would look like within a number of days. And then throw in the other thing on the top of this as well, that it is also being shelled and it is being bombed from the air. So it is an unimaginable kind of like circumstance to find yourself in.
Yeah, in terms of the destruction in there, the Hamas-controlled health ministry, whether we can trust these figures or not, said around 2,750 people have been killed and 9,700 wounded. Am I being too strong or too emotive when I say that the Israelis could be, they can be justifiably accused of collective punishment on the one hand, and could there be even an element of ethnic cleansing involved here and opportunistic move by Israel?
Well, we see these cycles, and I think probably most of your listeners and yourself were around long enough to. We've seen these cycles reappear, every 5 to 10 years we have one of these cycles. And there's an incident, something happens, and then there's retaliation. And, the attacks there earlier in October in Israel were absolutely horrific. And, some of the deeds that were carried out were absolutely horrific. But then we have this incredible reaction that sees, we cannot separate Hamas from all of the Palestinians, and we see everybody in Palestine or in Gaza being targeted, and it's reasonably indiscriminate. Yesterday I think we had about 700 children at that stage had been killed. That's just children alone. Again, if we can believe these figures. So you can see where Israel's coming from. It's been attacked. Horrific things have been done to it. There's a huge element of anger there. There's a desire for retribution. But when you're operating in such a densely packed urban area, there's going to be civilian innocent casualties. And this is the problem for Israel all along. They want to punish Hamas. They want to take Hamas out of the equation. But they cannot separate Hamas out of all of the Palestinian population. And, while they're trying to kill Hamas, essentially, they're also killing other people who are proximate.
What would be your view, David? Is there anything in the Israeli thinking that we've had this problem, as they might describe it, for decades, while the Palestinians, of course, justifiably would say, well, we have had the problem of the Israeli maltreatment of our people for decades as well. Is there any element, given where it's reached now, of the opportunistic strategy that, as I described it, by Israel to possibly annex Gaza and integrate it into Israel proper and, in their view, solve the problem once and for all? Or would that be inviting trouble into their house?
I think the desire to do that may be there, and we've had utterances recently, you know, from Netanyahu downwards about solving the Hamas problem once and for all. And that seems to be the agenda here. Now, how do you kind of close that loop? I really can't see how that's going to happen. I mean, to do a full-scale invasion into Gaza, to do an occupation of Gaza, you know, to get into an urban campaign in that environment is going to be terribly punishing for the Israeli army. This is not something, they're not just going to roll in here. You know, urban fighting is casualty intensive. It's the worst type of environment to get into. So whereas they might desire that they want to do that, they want that to happen, I cannot see how they're going to make that happen on the ground.
And dare I say, that kind of thing, Hamas has said it would welcome it, bring them in. But it will also lead, ultimately, many of these will consider themselves martyrs, as many of the 1,200 Hamas fighters will have considered themselves as martyrs for their cause. So that brings an element into the equation of extremism, of the type of opposition that Israel will face that you've just outlined there. But there's the not inconsequential total destruction of Gaza on the one hand, and the possible deaths of up to 270 hostages held by Hamas.
Well, yeah, I mean, the kind of like the line on the hostages is interesting because Israel has already started doing some kind of some level of raids in to try and identify locations and get hostages, etc. And that is up there the agenda, and they're talking about wanting them back. At the same time, the families of some of those hostages are saying they're not getting too much support or care from the Israeli government. They've actually formed their own support group to try and lobby the Israeli government to do something and to get information. And a lot of those families are actually, what they want to see is prisoner exchange, that this is a bloodless way of doing this. Like, can we give, there are plenty of Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails, can we do a prisoner exchange? So there's a certain amount of pressure there coming from the families to do something a different way. And then also, interesting, one of the Israeli government ministers made a comment that these people might have to be sacrificed a couple of days ago. So what the end route is going to be for those people who must be terrified and living in dreadful conditions, what the end route for that is, I don't see. I cannot see at the moment either. I can't imagine for a moment that everybody's going to be got back.
Right, and lads, if you listen to me next door there, don't worry about that. We can do it again tomorrow. We can do it tomorrow. Okay, thanks, Caoimhe. Sorry, David, for coming across there. It's just an issue with the production. Is this a proxy war, David?
Proxy war by whom? No,
with maybe a Russian finger in the pie?
Iran is a supporter of Hamas. It's also a supporter of Hezbollah. And Iran has, Iran has no sympathy for not only the state of Israel, but for the people of Israel. It doesn't want that to exist. That's been explicitly said from Iran on numerous occasions. So if you apply the old rationale, it serves their interest. It serves their interest. There's also been suggestions of Russia stirring the pot here as well.
Do you believe that?
I haven't got enough evidence to believe it.
It might distract the attention of the Western powers from Ukraine?
Yeah, but I mean, I think at the end of the day, you've got two entities here, Israel and you've got Hamas, who have basically enough hate in the system to go ahead at their own agenda. You know, if it suits other people's purposes and if other people want to support them, that's to their benefit as well. But there's enough animus between these two entities to keep them going in their own right.
And finally, David Murphy, geopolitically, with the Americans sending their battle fleets and biggest aircraft carriers and everything else, how much influence do you think they can actually bring to bear to prevent this happening?
You know, it's interesting. The American thing is interesting, and we've seen this. We've seen this in 2006, and we've seen this previously. We've seen situations where these kind of situations would develop. And Israel is very reliant on American support and American weapons. But at the same time, it is very willing to go its own route and basically say to America to stay out of its affairs. You know, there's a huge amount of diplomacy going on at the moment and back channels between UN and EU, and Joe Biden's trying to weigh in there as well. But, you know, we've seen this in the past. You know, a certain pattern seems to start unrolling, and it's very, very difficult to divert them from it.
All right. On that note, we'll watch... Yes, David, thank you. We'll watch the horrific events as they unfold over the next couple of days and keep a focus on it here as well. Director of MA in Military History and Strategic Studies at Maynooth University, Dr. David Murphy. David, thanks for your time.
No problem.
Appreciate that, and good morning to you.